You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Farag.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we explore the classroom of the future with social entrepreneur Sal Khan, whose free online education platform is seen by some as an education revolution.
First, protests have been escalating over an oil pipeline, which is being constructed just a mile from Native American land in North Dakota. Over the last few weeks, members of an unprecedented number of tribes from around the country, more than 200, have gathered to protest the pipeline, along with representatives of environmental organizations. The protests have gotten support from celebrities and Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein, who officials said yesterday is facing misdemeanor charges after spray-painting a bulldozer at a rally protesting the Dakota Access Pipeline.
The issue goes back much further than the last few weeks, though. Construction of the oil pipeline started in May of this year. If completed, it would carry a half a million barrels of crude oil through North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Illinois.
Joining us now to tell us more about the protest and what's at stake is Levi Rickert. He's editor-in-chief of the daily web publication Native News Online and a member of the Potawatomi tribe. Levi, thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
So what are some of the biggest concerns that protesters are bringing up related to this pipeline?
Well, the major concern is water is life, and they want to preserve the water of the Missouri River, and the pipeline actually will go into the Missouri River several locations and other waterways throughout North Dakota. And the second major thing would be that where the pipeline is going is on historical, ancestral, sacred land where there are burial grounds. And so they are very upset about that. And And I think the third thing would be really overall just the environment. You know, what does oil do to the environment and that type of thing with fracking, because some of the where it originates, so the oil will be coming down from oil that was processed through the fracking process. So
let's talk about the protests themselves. In the latest, we understand this afternoon, North Dakota Governor Dalrymple just called on the North Dakota National Guard to assist with pipeline security there against the protests. There's been private security involved so far. Can you talk some about the form the protests have taken and the security response?
Well, I think the National Guard was deployed prior to tomorrow's announcement. There's going to be a major court decision that will be rendered tomorrow in the district court, District of Columbia Court in Washington, and the anticipation is, that either side will react in a maybe a negative way. And I know that the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe's chairman Archibald has called for calm and peace. He wants whatever decision be made, because there, in all likelihood, will be an appeal filed either side. And so he's really calling for calm. And from my perspective, the National Guard might be a good move in that last Saturday, the private security company unleashed attack dogs on a group of American Indians that were trying to protect land from bulldozing taking place, desecrating burial sites. So maybe the National Guard would give a more of a balanced approach, I'm thinking, hopefully.
Talk a little more about those sacred sites. I understand the sites being bulldozed were ones that were brought up in this court challenge that we're waiting for a result on tomorrow. The bulldozing of those sites didn't wait for tomorrow's ruling. Talk about them a little more, please.
Well, most tribes now have archaeologists on staff, and the archaeologists from way back when the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers were waiting for input from the tribes, it basically said, we know where some of the burial grounds are. And for obvious reasons, the tribes just aren't going to necessarily announce where the burial grounds are because of grave robbers and all that. And given that, it came to light that they were pinpointed right through where the construction was taking place, the burial sites. And these are sacred burial sites. And I guess I've been telling people that if I were to take a bulldozer and start bulldozing a cemetery, I would be arrested on the spot, because I would be put on the local media would call me a monster. Well, I guess as a Native person, I question, why is it that, even though they're ancestral remains, why is it that they can bulldoze our graves and not think American Indians wouldn't be upset? And that is one of the major issues here is the total disregard for ancestral tribal lands.
Talking to Levi Rickard with Native News Online, looking at protests over an effort to construct a pipeline from North Dakota down to Iowa. Levi, this could be seen as a local issue for the tribe involved, but as we mentioned, people from scores of tribes around the country are participating. Why has this been something that's brought Native Americans from around the country together?
Well, it's something that I think that this is a new generation of American Indians that, you know, many of us have heard the stories from when the American Indian Movement took over Wounded Knee back in the 70s, and some grandparents may have been involved, aunts, uncles, moms, and dads. But this is a movement that allows for the young American Indians to say, hey, you know, enough is enough, and we're going to fight for what we think is precious to us. And water is precious in ancestral land. So I think that it was something that resonates with Native people, because in many locales across the country, and some of the reporting that I've been getting from people on the ground there have told me that people come and they say, you know, the same thing happened, but maybe a little smaller level version of it, but maybe a court has ruled negatively against a tribe, and you don't have to go back too far that uranium was mined on the Navajo Nation, where hundreds of people developed cancer as a result of some of the mining that took place. And so it really resonates that so often our lands are tampered with, and there again goes back to total disregard to who we are as Native people. So I think it was really easy to mobilize people. And in my lifetime, I think this was maybe one of the most single largest acts of solidarity and even unity among tribal nations across the country.
You've been critical of President Obama's response, or limited response, I guess, to the pipeline starting in North Dakota. What would you like to have seen from the president that you haven't seen?
Well, the president visited Standing Rock Reservation, right where it's happening, 2 years ago, and he went back to Washington, and he has been a really great president for Native people, and that's what he said. But yesterday, when he was questioned by a foreign correspondent in Laos, it was quite apparent that he was really clueless as to the significance of what was really happening in North Dakota. And he turned around and said, "I need to talk to my aides about this." He didn't have enough information. So to me, that was very disappointing for a president who will be meeting with all tribal leaders at the end of the month. His final tribal nation summit conference will take place in Washington, D.C., and the White House summit on September 26th and 27th, and the president is set to address the tribal nations at that time. Hopefully, there'll be some resolution. He'll know what's going on and get on top of the game. I think there is somewhat of a balancing act, though, he's playing, because he has worked very hard during his administration to domesticate the oil that's used. There's so much opposition to foreign oil. And so, you know, I think that he may have thought the problem was solved, but maybe he did not know at his level that this was, in fact, going through the ancestral lands for a tribe where he visited, and he felt very strongly that he would like to help. And so we are asking for his help.
From what you've heard from protesters against this pipeline, is the hope that they just move the pipeline to less sensitive spaces, further away from water, not going through sacred sites? Or is the hope to stop this pipeline altogether?
I think that, and I've talked to some of the tribal officials, they actually would like to see it stop altogether. And I think it presents somewhat of a challenge, quite frankly, for people, because we all drive cars and we all use oil. So I think it's somewhat of a dilemma that, but their stance, even that, because I've asked that hard question, they're saying, no, stop the pipeline altogether. So that's the answer I've been getting.
Levi, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, my pleasure.
That was Levi Rickard. He's editor-in-chief of the daily web publication Native News Online and a member of the Potawatomi tribe. He talked to us about ongoing protests over the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota, a court ruling on an effort to stop that pipeline expected tomorrow. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, local and state officials said yesterday, and they called for the removal of thousands of lead water pipes across the state to address high levels of lead contamination found among children in Milwaukee and elsewhere. We'll talk with an investigative reporter about the plan and what it could cost.
First, for most of us, the word school might bring to mind a teacher, blackboard, rows of students at their desks. In other words, your typical classroom.
A new generation of educators and entrepreneurs are trying to come up with innovative ways to teach and to learn. The work of several of these education innovators is highlighted on a new television series called TED Talks, Education Revolution. It premieres Tuesday on PBS as part of its Spotlight Education Week.
Educator and social entrepreneur Sal Khan is featured in that series. He's an educator and social entrepreneur, founder and CEO of Khan Academy, a nonprofit free online education platform offering software, tutorials, and video lessons on academic subjects from kindergarten through college. He joins us now. Sal, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be here.
Well, can you tell us about the humble origins of this, what's now a big name, the Khan Academy?
Yeah, it was in 2004. My day job, I was an analyst at an investment firm. My original background was in technology, and my 12-year-old cousin, she was 12 at the time, was having trouble with math. I offered to tutor her just over the phone, and we used Instant Messenger because she was in New Orleans. I was in Boston at the time. That worked out well. Then I started working with her younger brothers. Word got around the family, free tutoring was going on. I soon found myself working with 10, 15 cousins, family, friends all over the country. And I started writing some software for them so that they could get practice, really fill in their gaps. And a friend suggested that I make videos to supplement that software. And those videos kind of took on a life of their own. My cousins famously said they liked me better on YouTube than in person. It soon became clear people who weren't my cousins started watching. And one thing led to another. I set it up as a not-for-profit in 2008. And, you know, today, as you mentioned, Khan Academy, we have over 42 million registered users. It's all free. We're not-for-profit. It's videos. It's exercises where you've been used inside and outside of classroom. We're translating to the major languages of the world.
Before we talk about innovation more generally, let's look at what you're doing at the Khan Academy a little more. The idea here isn't we're replacing all schooling with these videos, right? This is a supplement that teachers, students, homeschoolers, whoever could use, right?
Well, it could be a supplement or it could be a primary resource. But even as a primary resource, we never imagined that it was somehow a virtual tool should replace a physical classroom. It's not like a Amazon.com versus Barnes & Noble thing. What we imagine is if students can get on-demand explanations from their phone or from a computer, if they can get practice problems, especially ones that give them immediate feedback that adapt to their needs, that it really frees up the class for more human interaction, where a teacher can better differentiate instruction. They can take some students aside and do a more focused intervention. They can see that, okay, all my students have learned this concept. Now I can do a project on it or maybe a Socratic dialogue on it. So we view it as if you're a part of the world where you don't have access to a school, you know, say you're in a village in rural India, well, if you have access to a low-cost smartphone, you should be able to self-educate yourself through Khan Academy. But if you're in Wisconsin and you do have access to a school, that we can supercharge what happens in that school so that it empowers the teachers and the students. And, of course, can be used by two students on their own if they're having trouble understanding what their textbook is saying or reviewing something that was covered in class. Khan Academy can be a great place for them.
As we mentioned, you're featured in an upcoming PBS series on innovation in education. Do you think that there's a lot more room, that we're just sort of scratching the surface of available technology that could revolutionize the way we teach?
Oh, yeah. I think we're just at the very beginning right now. You know, we've had the last education revolution was about 200 years ago when we had the introduction of mass public education, which was a major education revolution. It really should be listed up there with, you know, the printing press and the invention of writing in terms of transforming humanity. You know, 300-400 years ago, it was not, you know, literacy rates were in the 20% or so range globally, even in wealthier parts of the world. And now in middle-income countries, they're approaching 100% literacy, and hopefully we get that for the rest of the world. What's interesting now is we have a chance with technology of revisiting some assumptions that we first made 200 years ago when we first did mass public education. In order to be able to reach everyone, we put 30 students together in a classroom. We move them all together at a set pace. The best that the instructor can do is kind of a one-pace-fits-all, give a lecture. It might be too slow for some students. It might leave some students behind, but there's not much you can do. But now with technology, we actually can start to differentiate for all the students, let the content be more personalized, and free up the teacher and free up the students for more interaction with each other.
I wonder, how do we measure the impact of new innovations so that we know we're not just, you know, throwing innovations in for innovation's sake, that we're actually getting some bang for our buck?
Well, I think the first important thing about some of the new innovations we're talking about is that we can actually measure them for the first time. Today, if we think about, you know, the current primary resource in classrooms, the textbook, no one has any idea on whether people are using it, how much they're using it. The textbook publisher doesn't know which pages are effective, which ones aren't. When they publish version 2 versus version 1, they have no idea whether it's actually better. Teachers don't know which items are being used and how. And so when you start moving to some of these digital platforms at a very baseline, you can even start saying, okay, well, that's being used in this way. The content creators can say, okay, let me try the second version and see if it leads to more engagement or whether the students are more likely to answer the questions right. You can immediately give more feedback and data to students as well. But, you know, we've also started doing efficacy studies in classrooms. You know, we did a pretty deep one in Idaho where we saw that time spent on a platform like Khan Academy led to much more than expected gains for students, more than you would even expect. You know, you'd expect a strong student to get even stronger, et cetera, but on average, we saw about 1.8 times the learning in a year that you would expect to see. Khan Academy right now, we're the official prep for the SAT, and we're working very closely with the College Board on understanding what typical gains are from, say, the PSAT in 10th grade to the SAT in 12th grade, and what the gains are when the students are using the personalized learning platform.
Talking to Sal Khan of the Khan Academy. He's the founder and CEO there. Talking about innovation in education, he and others will be featured on a PBS series kicking off next Tuesday called TED Talks Education Revolution. Sal, we have a problem in Wisconsin, pretty widely acknowledged, educational achievement gaps, especially between white and black students, wealthier and poorer students. How do we make sure that new innovations don't just help the people who are already doing pretty well do even better, and that they reach the people who need them the most?
Yeah, this is a central question for us. And, you know, we see it as two issues. There's kind of an awareness issue, and then there's an accessibility issue. The accessibility issue is maybe the harder one, where, you know, the 30% of families in the U.S. who don't have access to broadband are disproportionately in lower income and underrepresented minority communities. So we're as a small organization, we're not directly playing the role of how do we get access, but we talk to folks like Google and Comcast and the FCC, and we say, look, this is a major reason why you need to get more access for more students. The good thing is things like cell phone penetration is quite high, and broadband through things like cell phones. And so that's why we're trying to make a lot of our work accessible through things like mobile devices. You know, on things like the SAT, this is a big priority for both us and College Board. So we partnered with a lot of after-school programs, Boys and Girls Club, to make sure that there's access. A lot of it is just awareness. You know, folks who might listen to National Public Radio or 60 Minutes or you know, pay attention to things in the tech sector might know about things like Khan Academy, but a lot more folks don't. So how do we get awareness that this is all free? It's not for profit. It's all non-commercial. It's free tutoring for your child. It's a free textbook for your classroom. How do we get the word out there? And I don't want to pretend that by itself is going to fix the problem. A lot of what you just talked about are problems beyond the scope of, you know, just Khan Academy or just the education sector. There are issues of, you know, broader issues of poverty and inequity.
What kind of things do you hear from teachers who have maybe had experience using material from the Khan Academy?
Yeah, you know, we have over a million teachers using us in different ways. You know, some of them will just write our web address, you know, khanacademy.org on the chalkboard at the beginning of the school year and say, hey, if you ever get stuck or need any help, this is a pretty good resource for you. While at the other end of the spectrum, some teachers are using us as a primary resource where the students are going through the material, doing the exercise. The teachers are getting daily feedback on where the students are, and they're using that data to, instead of kind of a one pace for everyone, say, okay, those students are progressing, let them continue to progress. These students are having a little bit of trouble on negative numbers, let me do a very focused intervention with them. Or all of my class is now ready for ratio, so I can do a class project with them. And so they've moved their classroom to this more, I would say, kind of interactive, personalized model.
I want to bring on a caller. We've got Tom on the line in Madison. Tom, hi.
Good Good afternoon. It's an honor to speak with the founder of the Khan Academy. I work for the Wisconsin Department of Corrections, and I wanted you to just be aware we are going to be testing a device shortly that's called RACHEL, the Remote Area Community Hotspots for Education and Learning, which provides an offline learning environment. And the Khan Academy Lite is included in that content. And from what we've seen so far, we believe this is really going to ramp up and transform our education offerings and lead to great benefits for those who are incarcerated who sorely need greater educational achievement.
Tom, I want to jump in and give Sal a chance to respond as we're almost out of time, not just in the schools, but now in Wisconsin, anyway, in our correctional facilities.
Yeah, I mean, we're also really intrigued by this possibility. There's been experiments like this in other states as well. And we're actually hoping that, in prisons, they don't allow internet connection, so there's not communication with the outside. But if we can make versions of Khan Academy, there's a version called KA Lite, but if we can even do ones that are connected to the outside but avoid kind of non-academic communication, I think this is a huge possibility where people could, use that time while they're in prison really productively, possibly get, high school equivalency or college credit, and most importantly, just learn a lot. This is something that could be very exciting. We're also seeing similar things in, kids who are in hospitalized for long periods of time, can't go to traditional school, child athletes, but the prisons in particular are something that's close to our heart.
Sal, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's educator and social entrepreneur Sal Khan, founder of the Khan Academy, a nonprofit free online education platform. He's one of the featured speakers on the TED Talks Education Revolution series, which premieres Tuesday night on Wisconsin Public Television as part of the PBS Spotlight Education Week. Check local listings for airtimes.
Coming up, state and local officials say they hope to remove more than 100,000 lead water pipes across the state to address the danger of lead contamination in children. An investigative reporter provides details. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Storytelling with the Moth Radio Hour. On today's edition, a divorced woman does a complete makeover on her lifestyle. An Air Force veteran describes what it's like to be a member of the Honor Guard. And a computer hacker messes with the algorithms of OkCupid. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
Right now, local and state officials yesterday agreed that Wisconsin needs to urgently replace its lead service pipes. They're hoping to prevent a serious public health crisis like the lead contamination scandal in Flint, Michigan.
Recent tests show that a high percentage of children in Milwaukee have been exposed to unhealthy levels of lead. But the problem isn't limited to Wisconsin's largest city, says Department of Natural Resources Secretary Kathy Stepp.
I hear from people who live in Ashland who are suffering from these same challenges. There's Beloit, there's Kenosha, there's Janesville, there's Racine.
Dee Hall is with us now. She's managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Dee, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
So the issue of lead in pipes in Wisconsin around the country, it's not new, but here in the state, what prompted local and state officials to decide this is urgent and it needs to be handled soon?
Well, first of all, it's the Flint, Michigan was a main impetus. You know, the notion that lead is not good for you and that lead pipes are not safe. It's actually been around for a while, some would argue for centuries. But it wasn't until the Flint crisis, I think, that it really brought home the danger of these lead pipes, because that's where the lead in water comes from. It does not come from a water source, generally speaking. It comes from the pipes that lead to homes and businesses.
And do you know how the lead pipe issue in Wisconsin, maybe zeroing in here in Milwaukee, how that compares to the problem that they had in Flint, Michigan?
Well, in Flint, the problem was they switched water sources from a Detroit water system source to the Flint River, and they failed, for whatever reason, it's still unclear why, to add something called corrosion control. And so when that highly corrosive water coursed through the system, it forced all kinds of lead to flake off the pipes and into the homes of people. And so what they saw was a doubling of the incidence of lead poisoning among children in the city.
So what about incidents of lead poisoning in the city of Milwaukee versus the city of Flint?
Well, right now, about 8.4, I believe it is, percent of children who are tested in the city of Milwaukee are diagnosed with lead poisoning. The issue, however, is that water is not tested as a routine part of an investigation when a child is lead poisoned. So the home, if a child has a high enough level, the state and the local county health department come in and they look at the child's environment. But water is, they're not required to look at water, and most of the times they don't. They look at lead paint, for example. That is considered the largest culprit.
So why has this been an issue that until now, until the consciousness kind of raising around lead pipes of Flint, Michigan, how is this flowing under the radar until now?
Well, I think it's the classic, lots of things are problems out there, and it focuses the public's attention by having a disaster like Flint. What I will say about lead is it's like several other pollutants and things that you can't smell, you can't taste it, most people don't know if they have lead pipes or not. The stuff's underground. It's very difficult to know just by drinking your water that you have a problem.
And so there was this event in Milwaukee yesterday, the Marquette University Symposium with DNR Secretary Kathy Stepp, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett saying that it's time to make an effort to remove these lead pipes. Do we know how soon or how solid this plan is?
A plan would be too strong of a word. I think there is a desire on the part of the state and the city to remove the lead service lines. There's a big problem, though, like a logistical problem. There's a financial problem. One of the biggest problems that they typically run into in these kind of projects is the homeowner owns half of the pipe, and the city or municipality or the utility owns the other half, and it's very difficult to coordinate a project like that. Replacing it costs thousands of dollars. In the state of Wisconsin, I'm understanding, based on the symposium yesterday, that the utility is not allowed to take the private portion and pass the cost of replacing that along to all of the ratepayers. So it's sort of a property ownership problem and issue. It's also a funding issue. Milwaukee has done some preliminary estimates that it'll be $511 to $756 million to replace their 70,000 lead service lines.
And I imagine doing something like that in the city of Milwaukee alone, let alone the state of Wisconsin, that's an enterprise that's not going to be over in a year or two.
No, it'll take a long time. Everyone pretty well acknowledges that. In the meantime, people can protect themselves using things like filters on their faucets. They can flush their water before they use it. Those are proven methods to remove some of the lead. But so long as the lead pipes remain there, the chance that you can or members or your family can ingest lead is just always there. So, for example, Mark Edwards, who was the man who led the testing in Flint and was sort of the spearheaded, uncovering what was going on in that city, he basically said nobody should ethically ever be told that their water is safe so long as it's being delivered by a lead pipe.
Are people being told that now?
No, they're not. No, the messaging is very interesting because the mayor, Mayor Barrett, yesterday stated that the water is safe according to everyone he's talked to. But then when he asked about is it safe for infants, he was told by his public health officials not really. So, that's a pretty alarming thing. I think the public utilities are trying to not overly alarm people, but people like Edwards believe that they need to simply be more forceful and be more honest with people and saying, so long as you have these lead pipes leading to your home, you've got a problem.
We're talking with Dee Hall right now, managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, talking about calls yesterday with Mayor Tom Barrett, DNR Secretary Kathy Stepp, calls to replace all of Wisconsin's lead water service lines to reduce the incidence of lead poisoning that have been shown to be especially high in parts of the state like Milwaukee. And And Dee, you mentioned earlier that water filters came up yesterday and were said to be effective at getting the making the drinking water safe, reducing those lead levels. But it sounds like those filters cost $30. And I imagine for some families, $30 is a lot of money.
And I think $30 is a part of the problem. But another part of the problem is if it's not maintained, if the filter stops working, you may not even know that. So, you know, individuals would be essentially left responsible for their own water quality, even though they're hooked up to a city system. And that gets to be a real problem, because when you get water from a city system, you are assured and assume that it is safe. And yet there are many things that could go wrong with a filter. Some of them have cartridges that have to be replaced. So it's not a permanent solution. It's a stopgap measure that works well, that is effective. But so long as you have those lead pipes in there, that danger of it releasing lead into your water is just there.
The Environmental Protection Agency has set 15 parts per billion as the level at which action should be taken to ameliorate that. So do we know what the range is in places like Milwaukee?
Well, so what the federal lead and copper rule requires is that they sample, that the city utility sample a certain number of homes every, in this case now, every third year. So of all the homes in Milwaukee, there are 50 locations that are tested every third year. And that's in a city with hundreds of thousands of people and 70,000 lead service lines. So you can imagine that they're probably not fully capturing the full extent of whatever problem there might be. And then Mark Edwards made some pretty provocative statements yesterday during the symposium, saying that he hates to even bring this up, but he believes testing is almost worthless.
And why? Why does he say that?
It was pretty shocking, because lead doesn't have a regular, scheduled, predictable release. A piece of lead can become dislodged and create very, very high levels in the water at any moment. For example, I looked at the study that Milwaukee did when it replaced its water service or its water mains, and during that work, they had to disconnect the existing pipe going to the home. And that disruption of the lead pipe can send lots of lead into the home. So they did a series of testing, but in some cases they would do 12 sequential tests, the same tap, one right after the other. One would come up two parts per billion, the next one 199 parts per billion. So he just said it's just too unpredictable. These random tests where you show up and you take a little bit of water every third year is simply never going to tell you. In fact, he called the entire regulatory scheme around lead and copper in a sick joke on the U.S. population.
So it sounds like, at least according to this expert and maybe some of the data you're talking about, that the only real fix is replacing the pipes.
That's kind of what the conclusion was of some of the top folks there yesterday. I know that, you know, Kathy Stepp said if it costs a lot of money, then it costs a lot of money, which I was really surprised to hear, because obviously we have a fiscally conservative administration, which is not really looking to spend more money on government services. But she made it very clear that she felt that government, this is a role for government to play, is ensuring public health and safety.
We're talking right now about calls to replace all of Wisconsin's lead water service lines to reduce the incidence of lead poisoning that's been shown to be especially high in areas of the state like Milwaukee. And Dee Hall is joining us now. She's managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. A link to her article on this issue is up right now on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have lead service lines coming into your house or community? Have you recently had them replaced? Do you think current legislation is enough to protect residents from a situation like the one in Flint, Michigan that's gotten so much attention? What would you like to see city, state, local officials do about it? What are you doing about it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our discussion about lead water pipes in the state and calls to remove them as soon as possible.
What do you think? What would you like to see state and local officials do about the possibility of lead contamination in drinking water? Who should pay for it? Is this a problem you've dealt with in your community, in your home? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Dee Hall, stays with us. She's managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. We'll take a first call now. Jake is joining us in Madison. Jake, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question for your guest is, I read when the Flint crisis was going on that the return on investment for replacing lead pipes was something like $7 or $14 on the dollar. So while it's a big cost to make the change, it's definitely worth it in like public health savings and then the education gains and when you're not limiting the intelligence of the children in the community. So I was wondering what the guest comment is on that.
Jay, great points. Thank you. Dee?
Yeah, I think that is a good point because the State Department of Health Services puts out an annual report on the percentage and number of children who are lead poisoned and where they are. And they emphasize in every report that that this lead poisoning costs the state billions of dollars with a B every year because children are lead poisoned, because studies have shown that children who are lead poisoned are much more likely to commit crimes later. They have problems in school. And these changes and problems are permanent and lifelong. And so the notion that there's a sort of an acceptable level or that somehow this isn't worth the time or the money, I think the state and top leaders in the state are now coming to the conclusion that this may be worth the investment. The question is going to be who exactly pays and how much will it be?
And on that question, what are the theories on the table?
Well, the city of Madison is one of the few municipalities in the entire nation that did this. They did it. They finished it over a 10-year period. And what the city did was the city paid for its portion, and then it offered a discount or rebate to some extent to the homeowners and then allowed them to pay back their portion over time. So that's how they did it. You can imagine that's kind of a cumbersome system. And when you're talking about people with very little money, which you might find in inner city Milwaukee, for example, that was one of the issues that the mayor raised is, you know, I'm not sure we're going to get absentee landlords and very, very low-income people able to cough up $3,000 or $5,000 to solve this problem.
Well, Jake, thank you so much for the question. And time for a brief question here from Paul in Wausau. Paul, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to ask?
I have a question. Mm-hmm. I was just calling in to say that I appreciate the program.
Thank you.
I'm calling from Wausau, but my first home was in Milwaukee. And I think your guest would verify this, that most pre-war homes in Milwaukee have a lead service pipe. I know I was advised when I bought it from the realtor that it could be an issue and that they were responsible for it, I guess half of it.
Okay. Paul, thank you for that.
Right. Yes, it's definitely of the 176,000 estimated lead service lines, about 40% of them are in Milwaukee. And of course, they are concentrated in homes that were built before 1950.
So as you said right now, saying that there is a plan in place that's too strong, but there is a political will to have a plan, I guess, at this point, and some momentum behind it. What do you expect to happen next, Dee?
Well, I did talk with Senator Lena Taylor during a break. She had attended the forum, and she felt that something is going to happen, that people are finally waking up to the problem and taking it seriously. She was frustrated. She felt like the folks yesterday didn't go far enough, but I think she is feeling like this is an issue that can't be ignored.
And so in terms of getting Milwaukee with the lead pipes replaced, that's part of it. The rest of the state, what do you expect there?
Well, this DNR has made a start. They allocated $14.5 million worth of grants to 38 communities around the state, including I think it was $2.6 million to Milwaukee for the express purpose of digging up not just the utilities line, but also paying for the replacement of the homeowners line. So there were some hints yesterday from Kathy Stepp that they will want to possibly look to expand that program, possibly look to provide filters in the meantime. There is no plan right now, but there are some possible changes that will be coming down the road.
Well, Dee, thank you so much for joining us and talking about this issue today.
All right. Thank you.
That was Dee Hall, managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. And she joined us today to talk about a new call from Mayor Tom Barrett and DNR Secretary Kathy Stepp to go forward crafting some kind of plan and initiative to replace lead pipes in Milwaukee and the state of Wisconsin as a whole.
There's been a major change in the whooping crane experiment here in Wisconsin this year. Humans wearing crane costumes are no longer teaching young birds to fly behind ultralight aircraft. Instead, crane chicks mostly now are being raised by adult cranes in hopes that the chicks will, years from now, become better at successfully reproducing in the wild. Chuck Kornbach reports.
By one key measurement, number of adult birds, the 15-year public-private effort to create a migrating flock of whooping cranes in the eastern U.S. has been a success. This time of year, if you're near the right marsh, you can hear the cranes make a call like this. Each summer, about 100 of the federally endangered whoopers live in the upper Midwest, mostly Wisconsin, before migrating in the fall to the southeastern U.S., mostly Florida. Some mature cranes have paired off and produced young, mainly at the Nisida National Wildlife Refuge. But many wild hatched chicks have not survived more than a few weeks or months, scientists say, mainly due to predators or habitat. 22 of 23 chicks hatched this year have died. Last winter, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service decided that bird reproduction and rearing might eventually improve if chicks hatched in captivity spent more of their first summer with captive adult cranes and much less time with costumed humans. That change has taken place this year with 9 chicks at a federal wildlife center in Maryland and with 3 youngsters at the International Crane Foundation near Baraboo. A recorder whirs in the conference room at the foundation offices, capturing a video feed from what's called Crane City, a secure breeding facility about a half mile away. The wall monitor shows 2 big white whoopers and a cinnamon-colored chick gently walking around and occasionally eating. Curator of birds, Kim Boardman, says she's learned a lot from watching this temporary crane family.
You learn those really subtle behaviors that how parents interact with chicks and how they get them to eat that piece of food that they really don't want to eat.
Chick rearing supervisor Marianne Wellington says she's noticed when the young start to wander a bit.
How much they stay really close to their parents, and then as the chick gets older and can forage more on its own, it's more like a toddler, you know, investigating the world and seeing what they can do on their own, but they're always connecting with their parent, you know, talking to them.
Later this month, the 3 chicks at the Crane Foundation will be put in crates and taken to cranes living in the wild. The chicks in Maryland will be flown to Wisconsin. Joe Duff of Operation Migration opens the door of the crane pen at the White River Marsh State Wildlife Area and shows where the chicks will live for a few days to get accustomed to the change in location. Duff says soon the birds will be let out and connected with adults across central Wisconsin.
That will give them opportunity to build their wings up because they've been in captivity all summer, and so they need to experiment with flying a little bit and get their wings going and their strength built up and get accustomed to the ways of the wild and spend some time with their adoptive parents.
Duff is one of the former ultralight pilots who led young cranes on past migrations. He says he's on board with a new technique to try to improve breeding. But the various people involved in the Whooping Crane Eastern Partnership acknowledge they're not sure how the fall migration will go and won't know for 4 or 5 years when the chicks mature if breeding will improve. Even a key architect of the change, Pete Fassbender of the Fish and Wildlife Service, admits to uncertainty.
We just know that the chicks released in the last 15 years, there was something missing in their behavior.
The success of the change in the Whooping Crane project could put the reintroduction effort on a path to finally building better reproduction of the endangered birds. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the major party presidential candidates answered questions on national security issues this week. It generated a lot of headlines. We'll take a look at some of the big security challenges facing the next president.
A guest makes a case that we should stop paying so much attention to political polls.
And on this week's edition of Food Friday, as a frugal person, I'm looking forward to this. Our guest shares recipes that help us use up all the stuff in our fridges. It's going to help us cut down, I guess, on food waste. I hate wasting food, but sometimes it just ends up in the compost.
Sometimes, which is a good place for it to go, but it'd be great to clean out the fridge and use all those late summer veggies.
That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.